pencil. I was calling for a pencil, but it was just a bureaucratic snafu. But there was a possibility that, well, the committee was possibly scheduling a vote that afternoon. And in fact, they did vote that afternoon. And it was in that session. And these papers had to be in order before that vote could be taken. So that was cleared up during the recess. It was in that session that Jesse Helms put his hold on making it clear this is nothing personal against Mr. Woodcock, et cetera, et cetera. And during the break, I went over to the luncheon in the Capitol that Paul Findlay and Adlai Stevenson put on for Hans Hsu. Were you there?
Oh, yes.
When Ed Muskie...
Yes, charmed. I led a cheer.
Oh, of course. How can I forget that? And Ed Muskie hypnotized the two lobsters. That was
fun.
It was fun.
You know, I got in trouble because of that. It was televised. I mean, you remember there were TV cameras in there, and I was a college cheerleader, and I said, I was very reluctant to do this, but he said, no, come on, represent the administration. So I said, all I do is lead a cheer. So he said, all right, lead your cheer. I led the cheer for Hans Hsu. To great enthusiasm, everyone yelled.
I had to leave early, but I was there for that.
And then that was recorded on camera by ABC. ABC, months later, did a story on the immaturity and mindlessness of the Carter administration. And then they used this footage as an example of the type of people who were in the White House staff.
Good God, I never knew that.
Yeah.
That's incredible. That shows the immaturity of ABC,
yeah,
I would say.
Exactly.
And then that night, Sharon and I were invited to dinner at the Harrimans. It was a dinner in honor of Frank Church. And very, very pleasant dinner, but conducted entirely according to the old diplomatic rules. Had the period, preprandial period, and then we sat down to dinner, and then after dinner, we disbanded, and the men all met together, and the women went separately to meet together, and the men had a topic to discuss. Our topic for that evening was SALT II. Very interesting discussion because there were several senators there and so on, but I had learned only shortly before that I never could understand why diplomatic dinners in Peking had to last 3 hours. They always had to be exactly 3 hours. It was entirely improper to terminate one before that time, even though the period after dinner sometimes got to be quite painful. I never could find out why 3 hours. What's the magic about it? I had learned only shortly before this dinner from one of the diplomats at one of the other embassies that back in the 18th century, at diplomatic dinners, you would meet beforehand to have a drink and then sit down to have the dinner. Then after the dinner, there'd be a period of an hour in which the men would discuss on a previously assigned topic. Now, the topic had long since disappeared, but that hour with its void still remained. But at the Harrimans, it was followed exactly, including having a topic. So my confirmation hearing is over. The Senate committee voted that afternoon. That's correct. And the day after, on the 9th of February, I learned that Chuck Percy went to a luncheon of businessmen at the State Department. He said, "Through you, I want to thank the business community for the strong support." I'm wrong. This was after the vote in the Senate, when he thanked the luncheon of businessmen at the State Department. "Through them, the business community, for the strong support to Leonard Woodcock, which enabled him to be confirmed yesterday with such a substantial vote." So from that time, the balance of February was pretty much just
staying here,
putting in time, waiting. Right.
You were you involved in getting Mike Blumenthal ready for his trip?
No.
And you were not in China. Were you in China on March 1?
No.
You were not there. Where were you then when the Chinese attacked Vietnam?
I was here.
In Detroit?
17th of February. Yes, I was in Ann Arbor, as a matter of fact.
Is that right? So we didn't notify you, or you didn't come back to Washington for that set of deliberations?
No. The way Vietnam came in to the picture, see, we couldn't get a fix at all as to when the Senate was going to vote because of the hole by Jesse Helms. And so I couldn't make my plans to go back, because I couldn't go back until after I'd been confirmed and sworn in. When that suddenly came, towards the end of the month, when Senator Byrd just made it an issue of procedure, and there was a vote in the Senate in which Helms was overwhelmingly outvoted, that they were going to proceed with the vote. I remember I had made early in March a speaking engagement in California after I had been confirmed. Cy Vance asked me if I would cancel the California speaking engagement and get back to China as quickly as I could because of the continued presence in Vietnam of the Chinese forces. He said, I remember, he said, "State Roy's a fine person, but I think you need to be there." So then I canceled those other plans, and when I got back to China on the 3rd of March.
I see. Remember that. You know that we were given an advance warning. Were you ever brought in or read into what we were told ahead of time as to the attack, how we were informed it was going to occur, and all of that?
I don't think so.
No, at some point. Well, I don't. At some point, I should tell you. We got President Carter was in Atlanta to give Charleston. He gave a major speech on military affairs, and he was out of town with Spig. I got a call on Sunday that the Chinese wished to talk to Dr. Brzezinski immediately, and he was not in, so they said, "Well, we then wish to deliver the message to you." And this is, I surmised what it was about, I called Dick Holbrook and said that I would. I called Spig. Spig said, "I want no one else there but you, because we guess what it was about." But this is the one time where I really disobeyed Spig's instructions to me about not including the State Department, and I told Dick that he should come over. I drove down to my office early, and Mr. Tsao came in and read me the notice that the Chinese would be attacking in 12 hours. I think we gave us about a 12-hour notice. And then I immediately informed Zbig. But we have never disclosed that we were given, in fact, even a short courtesy warning. And we then began to plan for the National Security Council meeting. The president got back. It was, I think, a Monday when the president got back. And we had everything ready for him to go. He was quite supportive, by the way, president. The minutes of the meeting said, and that's why in the course of the meeting said, I sympathize with the Chinese. I believe their objectives are limited. That's when he disclosed what Deng had told him. The Chinese told us, by the way, exactly what they were going to do. They told us that it would be a limited incursion, that they would only take the city of Long Som. They would not go further. And we told them soon after that we could not support what they were doing, but we understood that it was linked to the attack on Kampuchea, which we also could not support. And I think they understood all along that our posture was one of not exactly that, not being able to support, but nothing that we would not allow it to in the least interfere in our growing relationship with China. You know that Cy Vance wanted Mike Blumenthal to cancel his trip on account of that.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. He was very strongly in favor of canceling the trip. And in fact, that was the first moment, and from then on, when China policy really did become a very contentious issue between Zbig and Tsai. And the president, every time from then on, came down on Zbig's side.
I know that when I got back to China, that all the Chinese, Deng Xiaoping in particular, would express themselves as being understanding of the American position relative to the Vietnam business.
Well, Vance was very worried. He thought that it could lead to a Soviet attack. He was just very nervous during the whole time.
So the vote was finally taken in the Senate on the 26th of February. I think on the previous Friday is when, the Thursday or Friday, that the majority leader had laid down the procedural business, which was voted on overwhelmingly. The vote set for the 26th, and the minute the vote was cast, I was in Rochester, Michigan, where I still had an apartment. And Vice President Mondale called me and gave me the vote of 85-14, I forget, which means practically everybody voted. And he says, I mean, well, that's almost as good as ivory silver or something. And so that same night I left to Washington. There had been no pressure at all on me to be around in Washington during that period. The next morning I saw Secretary Vance at 10:30. That's when he said, get back. Now the question had been raised that I should be, that I should try and be back in China on the 1st of March, which is logistically almost impossible because I still had to be had to be sworn in. On that same day of the 27th, I met with the Israeli ambassador, Ephraim Hebron, at the request of our Israeli desk. The reason he wanted to see me was, would I informally raise with the Chinese the possibility of cooperation between Israeli Israelis and the Chinese. There were so many areas they thought in which they could be helpful, mm-hmm. agriculture, irrigation, and so on. And told me something which I should have known and hadn't, how early they had recognized the PRC, mm-hmm. never to have had a response.
Oh, they received a response.
A negative response.
No, positive. Through Yu Nu of Burma. The Chinese were ready. You know who put the kibosh on that?
No.
Dulles. Dulles went to the Israelis and said that if they went through with that, he would cut them off at the knees.
Well, that I did not know.
That was to Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion, through Yu Nu, was the intermediary.
Well, that's extraordinary. I didn't know
In the early 50s, during the Bandung phase of Chinese foreign policy.
Ambassador Evron was too diplomatic to tell me that, because I made it clear I did not know how early they had moved, but he didn't fill me in on the rest
of it. Totally, the, this was even before the Chinese had discovered Nasser.
I see.
Now, the question is whether they established relations that would have been sustained over time. One can very well question that, but at that time, this was, I think, 1954.
When did the British move?
With the Chinese? Oh, immediately, 1954.
Well, Evron told me they were 10 minutes behind the British. So it could have been in 50.
Well, that part I didn't know. I know the 54 through Yu Nu.
Yeah. But, so I did. Very unofficially, but got absolutely no response.
Big tried that also.
Yeah. Then on the 28th of February, I see that I spent time with Jim Moran, who was in charge of administrative matters as far as our mission was concerned. Harry Thayer, Don Anderson, who I guess was already slated to go to Shanghai at that time.
No. Don was
number two man.
Number two DCM.
Right, okay.
Right. That didn't come about until late summer, I think.
Then at 1:45, I met with you. Obviously, all of these had to do with
maybe Vietnam, with me.
Yeah. Then I was sworn in at 2:15.
As Mike Blumenthal was in China at that time.
Yes.
Negotiating the claims asset settlement,
right.
And
In fact, I think we met over at the State Department because you attended the swearing in.
That's right.
Which was at 2:15 and. Handled by David Newsom as the deputy secretary. And then I went up on Capitol Hill for a meeting with three different congressional caucuses, but because of the limitation of time, they were all grouped together.
Before we move off this is now you're ready to go out to be fully the ambassador. It's a good time to break for the interview, but what was the thoughts, to the extent you can call them, what were the thoughts of Harry Thayer, Don Anderson, as to how normalization had been carried out, and also how the Deng Xiaoping trip went? Was there a lingering bitterness over their non-involvement, feeling it could have been done better?
I think there was some of that in Harry, but I don't think it was carried forward.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember ever being aware of any in Don Anderson.
Right.
And by this time, everybody was so involved with all the either the work going forward or the work that would be going forward,
right.
That I think all of that had really disappeared.
And had you been doing some interviewing, too, to increase your staff? Had you foreseen a major increase in staff? I know Harry was trying to put the pieces together so that you could have a bigger staff.
I had discussions about it, but I didn't talk to any persons. No. My ability to influence anything beyond the top posts was extremely limited. And my attitude was that since I didn't know any of these people personally anyway, I relied very much on Stape Roy. Do you know so-and-so? And he usually did.
Right.
Is there any reason why we should? You could block a person easily, but it was not so easy in the lower post to push somebody higher in on the conveyor belt, as it were. But no, I didn't do any of that. And so left then on the from Washington to the Northwest flight to Chicago, which then goes on to Tokyo. Arrived in Tokyo on the 2nd of March. Stayed at the residence with Mike Mansfield and had dinner there, and then the the next, Aunt Shu and his wife were in Tokyo at that time. And they came to the residence to have breakfast with us.
He was on his way back then, too.
Yes, I think he stayed over 6 days or so, and for some reason in Tokyo.
Great loss.
Yes.
For the functioning of the embassy. He had a keen political sense and an ability to get along with Americans that was sorely lacking after his departure.
Yeah, I think China would have been better served had he stayed in Washington than there were others, particularly with Mr. G there, who could,
that's right,
who could furnish the insight in Peking.
That's right.
And so that afternoon went on to Peking and arrived there on the late Saturday.
Good.